Test, test, test. It was muted somehow. There we go. All right, we're gonna get started. So if you're in the hallway, make your way in. If you're walking, don't close your eyes while I'm praying because you'll fall down. But let's pray. Lord, thank you so much for this morning. Thank you for the privilege and joy we have today to, as a body, as a church, to celebrate the ordinances of the church, Lord, to partake in the Lord's Supper, to spend some time examining ourselves, to let you search our hearts, to cleanse us, to make us right with you, that you would purge us with hyssop, as David prayed in Psalm 51. I pray that you would encourage us as we recognize the great gift we've been given through your Son of a right relationship with you. And I thank you that we can concentrate on that this morning. And Lord, thank you for the privilege to celebrate the Lord's Supper together. Thank you also for the joy we have to watch those who have expressed faith in you to publicly identify with you through baptism this morning. And Lord, I'm eager to hear the sermon preached by the testimonies of those who have been changed by your grace, who are different because of the work you're doing in them. And I thank you that we have the joy of together watching that happen. And I thank you that you've given birth to this thing that was a mystery in ages past, this thing called the church, in which Jews and Greeks live together and operate together. This is where two have become one, and where we are your bride. And I thank you so much for that reminder even this morning. Lord, as we now dig into Numbers, I pray that you would encourage us as we watch your faithfulness again to your people, as you continue to demonstrate faithfulness to them, and as in this case, in this chapter, they seem to respond in faithfulness to you. I thank you for just that example for us, and I pray that it be something that we strive for in our own lives. Thank you for each one that's here, and thank you for this opportunity to glorify you. We ask this in your name. Amen. All right, we're in Numbers chapter 21 this morning. Numbers 21. And we looked a little bit last time at the bronze serpent. Just really screamed through the first part of the bronze serpent. So we'll actually start there and see how far we get through the book, through the chapter, Numbers chapter 21. So now they've set out from Mount Hor. They're heading around Edom, and they're going to be heading up to the east side of the Jordan. That's the first place they're going to go. That's where the first place they're going to take land is, on the east side of the Jordan. And as they're going, they come to this instance found in Numbers chapter 21, starting at verse 4. The Mount Hor, they set out, by the way, to the Red Sea and to go around the land of Edom. And when the people became impatient on the way, and the people spoke against God and against Moses, "Why you brought us up to die in this place, in this wilderness? There's no food, no water, and we loathe this worthless food." Then the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, that the people of Israel died, so that many people of Israel died. The people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord that he may take away the serpents from us." So Moses prayed for the people. The Lord said to Moses, "Make a fiery serpent, set it on a pole, and everyone who is bitten and sees it shall live." So Moses made a bronze serpent, set it on a pole, and a serpent bit anyone, he would look at the bronze serpent and live. So they were complaining again. No food, no water. In fact, the food they had, they said they hated it. The food was manna that they got free every morning, but they were sick of it. It's been almost 40 years. They've been walking around eating that stuff. So, you know, sometimes I get that. That doesn't mean the food wasn't good. It just means they were tired of eating it. And once again, their complaint is against God and against Moses. And why have you brought us out here? You brought us out here to die in the wilderness. Well, Moses should have said, "Yep, that's why you're here. You're going to die in the wilderness. That's part of the plan, and it's your fault, not mine." But he doesn't say that. He actually goes to God for them. Or actually, God sends fiery serpents. Now, there's a lot of guesses. You read, there's a lot of guesses as to what kind of serpents they were. You know, some kind of asp, some kind of, I don't care what kind of serpent that was. We don't know what kind of serpent it was. It was a serpent, and this serpent bit people, and when this serpent bit people, it died. It could have been a naturally occurring serpent. It might have been a miraculous serpent prepared by God to go through. Don't know. Don't know what it was. But it was wreaking havoc in the land. It was wreaking havoc in the people, not in the land, in the people, because whoever it bit, it says, died. Now, there's apparently a period of time between snake bite and death. Has to be. Because if snake bite brought instant death, you wouldn't have time to look on the bronze serpent, right? Oops, sorry, didn't work for you. So there had to have been a period of time between snake bite and death. We don't know. We're not told. You know, I read everybody trying to guess what kind of venom this was. Was this like a rattlesnake kind of venom that affected the bloodstream, or was this a cobra type venom that affected the nervous system? I don't know, and you know what? I really don't care. I don't need to know that. All I need to know is there were fiery serpents that bit people, and the idea of fiery means that when they bit, it hurt, bit people, and after a period of time, if you got bit by this serpent, you died. That's what I need to know. And why did it happen? It happened because they were complaining. It's interesting. This is the seventh time recorded. The seventh time that the people of Israel have complained against God and against Moses for lack of water or lack of food. And so this is the time that he sends the fiery serpent. So they go to Moses. They immediately recognize, we're dying again. It's happening again. We've done it again. We've sinned against God. We've sinned against Moses. They go to Moses and say, hey, Moses, we've sinned against God. We've sinned against you. Please pray to God. Please ask him to take away these fiery serpents. And earlier, at least in the examples before, when they've done that, God has either fixed the situation or taken the thing away immediately. That's not what he does here. The snakes don't go away immediately. They continue biting people. The serpents keep biting people, and they're still there. But the remedy is not that the snakes and serpents go away. The remedy is that if you get bit by the serpent, Moses is supposed to build this replica of the fiery serpent. It's set up on a pole, and so that he sets it up so that anybody who looks at the serpent would then be healed. Now, this is, you might ask, isn't that idolatry? Isn't that idol? Isn't Moses doing something that he has been told, been commanded to not to do back in Exodus chapter 20? Don't make any graven image. I have no other God before me. I don't think that's what's going on at all, because it doesn't say make a representative for me that is the bronze serpent, and the bronze serpent will heal people. That's not what it said. It said build a bronze serpent. Anybody who looks on the bronze serpent will be healed. So the object of healing, or the thing that healed, was faith in what God said to do. It doesn't make any sense that when you have a poison streaming through your body, that the answer for that poison is to look at something? Does that make any sense at all? No. In fact, if you came to me with a rattlesnake bite, right? If you walked out the door and you got a rattlesnake bite and you ran back in and you said, I've been bit by a rattlesnake. I'm going to, you know, and it's whatever kind of rattlesnake that's deadly. I'm going to die. And I said, okay, wait. And I ran in my office and I brought a brown, and I said, look at this and you'll be fine. You'd say, no, take me to the hospital and get me some anti-venom. That's how I'm going to be healed. It makes no sense for the answer to be, look at this, except for to say that's what God had commanded them to do, and they're going to. And so there was a measure of faith expressed in the one looking at the bronze serpent. There was a measure of faith because they had to say, okay, it's not anti-venom that's going to fix this. It is trusting God that His way is going to fix it. Now that had to be, especially for the first few people who got bit and looked. Now it's interesting to me that. Throughout history, from this point on, the idea of a serpent on a pole has with it healing. As I, you know, when you look at a medical practice, what does a medical practice look like? It's a serpent on a pole. Now, where does that come from? Not here. I don't think that comes from here. I think that's part of it. I think there's a Greek god. The Greek god of healing, whose name was Asclepius, and he was represented as a serpent on a pole. So I think the idea of the medical, the thing today comes from him, comes from Asclepius. But I think Asclepius draws himself out of what happened here. This happens way before the Greek culture has even begun. This happens really early on. This is hundreds of years, 700 years before the Greek things start. So this clearly predates the Greeks. So it could very possibly be that this legend is something that led to the development of the Greek god Asclepius. Very possible. Not necessarily probable, not necessarily a done deal. But it's interesting that, like I said, that when you look at symbols for healing, a snake on a pole is still something we look at as a symbol for healing. It's also interesting that this bronze serpent, this very bronze serpent, stayed with Israel until Hezekiah's reign. Hezekiah will destroy the bronze serpent in his reign. You want to know why? Go to the Kings and read why. I'm not going to give that to you today. You're going to have to actually do some work for something. You're going to figure that out. But Hezekiah destroys this very bronze serpent. Jesus actually refers to this bronze serpent in John chapter 3. Nicodemus has come to him, and Jesus is walking through what it means to believe, and he says that even as the serpent was lifted up in the wilderness, so must Son of Man be lifted up. I think there's significant. Now, boy, you could really preach a really good spiritualized message from that one. You really could, as the serpent bit the physical person in that day, so the serpent bites the unbeliever and he dies. Well, the only problem with that is your analogy falls apart because we're born dead. We're born dead. The serpent doesn't bite us to make us dead spiritually, so it falls apart. But anyway, the idea there is the lifted up. That's the parallel between the two. It's the lifted up. So this becomes, for Israel, a big deal, is something they point back to, look back at as one of the big deals in their history. So this serpent is lifted on a pole. When people look at it, they live. I don't think it's idolatry. I don't think it's even close, because it's not. The serpent's never been the one who was the one that healed. It was looking at the serpent, trusting in what God said, believing that his way was right, and doing it's what led to the physical healing of the people. That's the bronze serpent in a nutshell. Those few verses are all we get, except for Hezekiah destroying the bronze serpent and for Jesus saying, as the serpent was lifted up in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. That's what we know about the bronze serpent. Now we move into verses 10 through the end of the chapter 21, and it's really an interesting section. In this section, there are going to be three snippets of songs. Three snippets of songs. And it almost feels like, as you're reading it, that this section is written so that those snippets can be included in the text. Because he starts off saying where they set out from and how they went. And then he gets to verse 14, and he says, "Therefore, it is said in the book of the wars of the Lord," and he sings part of a song, or he writes part of a song. So let's talk just a little bit about that, all right? I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, but I think it's significant, because it feels like, or it seems like, each one of these songs came from a book that was called the Songs of the Wars of the Lord. It appears that, and I have to say it appears, because it's referred to, this book called the Songs of the Wars of the Lord is referred to, and so when an early Israelite, when a Jew in the land early on would have known exactly what's being talked about here when Moses writes about the songs of the wars of the Lord. We have no idea. We have no idea what it is, because it doesn't exist anymore. It's not in existence. There is no book anywhere that you can find that dates itself back to 1400 B.C., that is called the Book of the Wars of the Lord. We don't have it. We have these snippets from it, but we don't have it. There are other instances like this. the Old Testament also quotes a book, the book of Jasher. The book of Jasher. We don't know what the book of Jasher is or was. We don't have it anymore. Jesus and Jude quote a book called the book of Enoch. The book of Enoch. And we have a book of Enoch. I'm not sure that it's the same book that Jude and Jesus are quoting, but we have a book of Enoch. It's an interesting read if you want to do some really fun reading sometime, but it's clearly not canonical. It's clearly not something that should be part of the canon. And the reason I say that is because it contains error. It contains clear error. As an example, I'll just give you one example of the clear error it contains. When it's talking about the giants in Genesis chapter 5, it says the giants were 3,000 cubits tall. Okay, if you take a small measurement for the cubit, which is an 18-inch cubit, that means those giants were 4,500 feet tall. So Pike's Peak is 14,200 and something. So these giants would have stood a third as tall as Pike's Peak. No. No. Yeah. An airliner can go up to 45,000 feet or 49,000 feet. But, yeah. But anyway, I mean, just think 4,500, that's when the Jews could have said, we're like grasshoppers, because that's exactly what they would have been. There would have been no exaggeration at that point if that's the case. But, you know, there are those who have tried to make it by saying, look, we found these huge footprints, and you'll see doctored photos, and I'm confident they're doctored photos, of a man, a six-foot man, standing by a footprint that is 12 feet tall. Well, if you do that math, I have a 12-inch foot, right? My foot is 12 inches, and I stand 6 feet tall, all right? So do the math. If you have a 12-foot, well, that's a 60-foot tall man. Okay? That's not 4,500. So anyway, there's error in the book of Enoch, so it's not canonical and shouldn't be canonical. If someone comes to you and approaches you and says, I really think the book of Enoch should be in the Bible, just laugh and walk away, because they're not worth arguing with. So there are examples of books that are text or that are source material that aren't included in the canon. They're not included. Why? Well, because they don't exist anymore, and God preserves His Word. God preserves His Word, and if God didn't preserve those books, then those books aren't part of the Bible. They would have been preserved. Because there are books written almost as old as them that are preserved. What examples do we have of books that are almost as old as the Book of the Wars of the Jews that have been preserved? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Okay, I tricked you. I really tricked you. I got you. Those are books? Yeah, those are books written by Moses just the same way that other books were. So these were preserved. That one wasn't. That's why it's not. But what this section does is it walks through some of the events. So once we leave Arad, remember that was their first kind of mini victory. More of a nuisance battle than anything else, because remember those folks from Rod came against them and were trying to stop them, and they took care of them really quickly, but they don't enter the land there. They actually are still going to go up and go around the east side of the land, go around the east side of the Jordan and take some land there before they cross over into the land. So it's their first mini victory, if you will, but they're approaching their first couple real victories that are recorded here in chapter 21 of Numbers. So the stage is getting set, and I think that it's interesting that the response you have as they're walking through, as they're approaching this place, it feels like a different response than where they've been so far. Up until Bronze Serpent, up until the seventh time they've complained against Moses, you notice this time they didn't complain against Aaron. Why did they not complain against Aaron this time? Because he's dead. It would have done no point in complaining against Aaron at this point. So they complain against Moses, but up and so fiery serpents. But here, from that point to chapter 21, all through chapter 1, there seems to be almost a worshipful and joyful response to what God is doing. Because as they're walking, they're going through places, and instead of complaining about, oh, this is terrible, this is hard, this is really tough, I can't do this anymore, why did you bring us out here? They're singing songs. A lot of folks have guessed as to spiritual significance of the songs. Notice I said a lot of folks have guessed as to the spiritual significance of the songs. I don't think you can figure it out. I can't figure any spiritual significance to the song except for the fact that they were singing. And I think that's huge. It's huge that they were singing because that is not normal for Israel. What is normal for Israel as they're walking, as they're moving, as they're going, what's normal for them is to complain. Remember, as they left Sinai to go up to the land, 11 days before they make that 11-day journey, what are they doing? They're complaining. Let's go back a little bit. Coming out of Egypt, less than 3 weeks out of Egypt, what are they doing? They're complaining. Seven times they're complaining. And yet here when you get to chapter 21, verse 10, there's no complaint. There's no complaint. And it's not because they didn't need anything and not because they weren't traveling. In fact, what's set out in verses 10 through 13 is the fact that they were traveling. They're really doing some moving here. They're moving from place to place. Just look, it's and the people set out from and camped at Oboth. And then they set out from Oboth and camped at Lyarbarim and in the wilderness opposite Moab toward the sunrise. There they set out and camped in the valley of Zered. From there they set out and camped on the other side of the Arnon, which is in the wilderness from the border of the Amorites, for the Arnon is the border of Moab, between Moab and the Amorites. So they set out, they set out, they set out, they set out. It's not like they're just, you know, living in tents for a while, having a nice camp out, having a nice cookout and stuff like that. That's not going on. They're moving. They're on the move, and they're continually on the move. And that typically in their past has caused them to complain. But what do they do this time? What do they do this time? They break out in song. They break out in song. Therefore, it is said in the book of the words of the Lord, Wahab and Suphah in the valleys of the Arnon, and the slope of the valleys that extends to the Sea of Ar, that leans to the border of Moab. Woo, deep, deep song. I have no idea what it means. I'm sorry. I would love to tell you I think I know what it means. It's just saying, some folks call this the song of places because it just mentions some places. That's all it is. But I think it's interesting that as they're going, they're singing a song. They're singing a song. Yeah, Mike?
Mm-hmm. So that's why King's Island was so important, because that was really a lot of source of water, available water. And the desert island, which is about 30 miles east of that, was just that desert. There were a few places for water, but nothing compared to just 30 miles to the west. All those waters drained into the Dead Sea. It was pretty abundant. There was wildlife. There was all kinds of stuff. So it's kind of like an oasis.
Cool. And that could have led to their good mood, you know, the thing that's really interesting there is it feels like their attitude is different. It really does. It feels like their attitude has changed. It feels like, so what's going on here? Well, I think there's a couple things going on here. They're moving and they're progressing. They recognize they can keep track of years. They can keep track of time. And they know that 38 years have passed, and they're within 2 years now of entering the land. They know it's getting close. And they know how they're moving now. They know that in the past, for 38 years, they have followed a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire that has purposely led them around, wandering in circles. And now, if you track the progress, which I would encourage you to do, get a map and track their progress, you'll see that they're moving, it feels like, with a purpose. It feels like they're moving with a purpose to a place where they're going to actually accomplish something. And they actually have already accomplished something. They've defeated their first little skirmish. They're actually having success in what they're doing. And so I think all of that is leading to a response that says, wow, let's sing. Let's sing. And so they sing together this song. And then they keep going. But that, they don't stop. Verse 16. And from there, they continued to beer. Now they got drunk. No, it's not really what it means. Beer, is the well of which the Lord said to Moses, gather the people together so I may give them water. And Israel sang this song. Spring up, O well, sing to it. The well that princes made, the nobles that nobles of the people dug with a scepter and with their staffs. So now they're walking through the wilderness, and apparently they're thirsty. But it's interesting, they don't complain to God before he gives them water. God gives them water before they complain. There's no complaint here. It's interesting to me that God could have done that every time. He could have taken them to a place and given them water before they complained. He didn't. In this case, he takes them through, and apparently there is a need for water, because in some translations it actually says that God caused Moses to dig a well. And I think in some of Moses' own summary statements about this, it was God told him, dig a well here. And God provided water for the people from the well before they complained. And then how do they respond? They respond by singing a song again. It's cool. They're singing a song again. They're singing. And again, this is a song that apparently is also recorded in the book of the Wars of the Jews. Wars of the Lord. I'm sorry, the book of the Wars of the Jews. That is a Josephus book written much later, which is a good read, and you ought to read it if you get a chance. But anyway, we do have that one. The Wars of the Jews, it's a good book. But this book, this song is apparently recorded there too, and I have no clue necessarily what it means. Yeah, go ahead, Chris. Yeah, so that's, thank you. I said there was two reasons, and I only gave you one of the two why they were singing this time. Second reason is most of that old generation has died off, and this is a new generation that has watched and seen and has apparently, it feels like, at least a little bit, they're learning from the mistakes of their fathers, it feels like. Now, that doesn't last long. It doesn't last long at all. But at least for a period of time, when that old generation is dying, the new generation is growing up, it seems like there's a different response in this generation than there was in that first generation. And so I think that's part of it too, which is kind of to Chris's point that, you know, they've just seen, they've been disciplined, and potentially it's like, okay, we're not going to complain then. We're going to go to the land, because, again, I think they realize that they're nearly there and they're experiencing victories. So they sing again. And after they sing, and I'm not going to go into any significance of the songs, because I don't attach any spiritual significance to them whatsoever, except that they sang. I did like one commentator. He said, this is maybe the first example of secular popular music we have recorded in the Bible, because it has really no spiritual significance whatsoever. It's just a song that they would have sung as they were walking. It's a song they would have sung as they were getting water from a well. They're just song. There's no mention of God in the well song. It's not spring up a well and thank God for the water. It's just sing to the well. Stand up here and talk about the spiritual significance of Hotel California. I'm not going to stand up and talk about the spiritual significance of this song, because I don't think there is any necessarily. And maybe there is the Hotel California, I don't know. I just know you shouldn't listen to it. So anyway, and so now they've sung, and now they're going to move again. verse 18. And from the wilderness they went on to Matana, and from Matana to Nahaliel, and Nahaliel to Bamoth, and from Bamoth to the valley lying region of Moab by the top of Pisgah that looks down on the desert. This is a significant place because they now can see. It's interesting, most of the places mentioned here in this section specifically, we don't know where they are. We don't know exactly where they are. There's no present-day settlement where this is. Some have suggested that it's more of a description than it is an actual name of a place. I don't know. All I know is we don't know where these actual cities are, except that these are places they walk through. So any map you see that has these places pinpointed, it's just a guess because we don't know exactly where these places were, except for the fact that they were on the way from the wilderness to Moab. So that's where they find them. And now they come against an obstacle. They've been moving, they've been walking, they've been singing, they've been drinking water, not beer, they've been drinking. And by the way, beer means well, apparently, in Hebrew. That doesn't mean, you know, the yellow stuff in a 12-pack. Means well. So they've been walking, they've been singing, they've been doing that, and they come against an obstacle. And it feels like an obstacle they've already faced. They come against the king of Sion. Israel sent messengers to Sihon, the king of the Amorites, saying, "Let me pass through your land. We will not turn aside into the field or vineyard. We will not drink the water of the well. We will go by the king's highway and until we have passed through your territory." Where did we see that request made before? They asked Edom, right? Remember they asked Edom, "Will you let us pass through?" Now Edom, remember, are cousins. The Amorites are not cousins. The Amorites are not cousins like the Edomites were. And the Amorites say, "No. Sion would not allow Israel to pass through his territory. He gathered his people, all his people together, and went out against Israel into the wilderness and came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. And Israel defeated him with the edge of the sword and took possession of his land from the Arnon to the Jabbok, as far as the Amorites, for the border of the Amorites was strong." Now, this is a significant victory. This is a significant victory because if you understand world history, the Amorites had just defeated the Moabites. The Amorites had just won a significant military campaign against the Moabites. And so the Amorites now were actually kind of the power in the area. They were expanding their borders, and they were beginning to grow stronger, and they were beginning to become this conquering kind of nation. That's who the Amorites were. And so they had expanded their land. They just defeated some of the Moabites. They had just taken this place, and they're flexing their muscle as a nation, I think. So when Israel comes against them, not only do they say no, but they say, not only are we going to tell you no, but we're going to eliminate the threat, and we're going to eliminate it now. We recognize you're a big nation. We recognize you're a threat. We saw what you did in Arad, and we're going to eliminate you now. So the king Sihon brings his forces against Israel to wipe them from the face of the earth. And he is utterly defeated. He is utterly defeated. Israel comes against him, and Israel routs him. They take him out. They take everything he has. This is interesting because it begins to establish the reputation, not necessarily of Israel, but the reputation of Israel's God. Because this group of vagabonds should no way be able to overthrow this military power that the Amorites are. There's no way they should have won the battle. There's nothing about them that they should have been able to win that battle, except that God was with them and God won the battle for them. Yeah, Larry?
Remind me, is this the guy who went and got Balaam and said, "Bless me"?
No, we're getting there. That is Balak, who is the king of Moab. There's we should get there next week. And I think that's, well, I want to wait till we get to the next week. But that's the reason Balaam tries to attack them spiritually. Balak tries to attack them spiritually. It's because he recognizes we can't beat them militarily. Balak has just been defeated militarily by the guy who the Jews just beat. Balak has just lost some territory and a war to Sihon. And Sihon has just been utterly defeated by this Jewish nation coming up. And so that's why he says, I can't beat them militarily. I'm going to see if I can beat them spiritually. I'll take it out of the physical realm and I'll bring the spiritual realm into it and I'll get them cursed. I'll get them cursed. That's exactly his plan. That's next week. But the point is that there's this success for them as they come against this thing, and it is a huge success. I mean, it is overwhelming success, because it didn't just take some of the outlying cities. They didn't just take some of the outlying places. They took everything. Everything. Moses is going to recount this. As we get to the first chapters of Deuteronomy, Moses is actually going to recount this recent history for them. And there were over 60 cities in this area that they took during this conflict. So this wasn't a two-day battle. This was a taking of land. This was the conquest one. Or conquest.1, whatever you want to call it. It's the first iteration of conquest, because they actually go in and they take this land, but they take cities. And they take significant cities, because they take the city in which the king lived. They take his city. I'm not making that up. Verse 25, Israel took all the cities, and Israel settled in the cities of the Amorites in Heshbon and all its villages. For Heshbon was the city of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab and taken all his land out of his hand as far as the Arnon. So not only did they take just outlying cities, they took significant cities. They took major cities. It's also interesting to me that they begin to understand this is conquest. Remember when they did the Arad thing? They didn't stay there. They didn't live there. They didn't move into houses. Here it says they took cities and they settled in those cities. They recognize this is going to be home. We just found home. And so they begin to settle those cities that they're taking from the Amorites. So again, this is conquest.1. It's where they're actually going in. Therefore, the ballad singers say, and here's a little song, also in the wars of the Jews. Wars of the Lord. If you hear me say the wars of the Jews in this context, you know I mean wars of the Lord. Come to Heshbon, let it be built. Let the city of Sihon be established. For fire came out of Heshbon, flame from the city of Sihon. It devoured Ar of Moab and swallowed the heights of the Arnon. Woe to you, Moab! You are undone, O people of Chemosh. He has made his sons fugitives and his daughters captives to an Amorite king, Sihon. So actually, what are they singing? They're singing a Amorite victory song. And they're taunting the Moabites with the Amorite victory song. Basically, they're saying, we're singing a song and you're next. We're coming to get you. Hey, Mike? Yeah. Yeah, I think there's significance because we look at it today and we see Israel west of the Jordan and Jordan east of the Jordan, and we got this idea that, well, yeah, that's the way it's always been, that the Jordanians and Arabs have always had that side, and that's not the case. The land promised to Abraham included both sides of the Jordan, not just one side of the Jordan. And the land Israel got and settled and the part of the conquest was this side of the Jordan. It absolutely was. There's significant things that happened on the east side of the Jordan. There are significant things that happened there. And this is all considered part of their land. And it will be part of their land. In the millennial kingdom, this will all be part of Israel's land. They will reestablish themselves not just in a little bitty sliver of the land. They will reestablish themselves in all of the land. The land that Israel holds today is nothing compared to what they have been promised, and nothing compared to what they have held at other times in history. In Jeroboam 2, just before the Assyrian captivity, the northern nation expands and holds huge amounts of territory, more than they've ever held. The problem is they say, look at the great things we have done. Look at the great victories we have won. Look at how great we are. And God says, no, you're really not that great. In fact, I'm going to take it all away and move you out. And that's what he does. It's interesting that Nebuchadnezzar says the same thing as he's walking in Daniel chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar walks around and said, look at the great kingdom I have built. And he's humbled immediately. That was a good one. You got that for free. I find it interesting that the song they're singing here is not a song of Jewish victory. It's not even a song of how God provided them victory. That's why this doesn't seem to me to be a spiritual song. They are singing an Amorite victory song against the Moabites. And this clearly is the song that the Amorites would have sung in a taunt or in a victory march over the Moabites. Yeah, Mike? Yeah, I think that there's part of that. I think there is this. Yeah, here's what's behind the song. Sion did that, and we took him out. And I think there's clear taunt there. There is taunting. I think, you know, at this point, the referee would have thrown the flag and given a 15-yard penalty for taunting, because that's exactly what they're doing. They're taunting. Not only are they taunting Sion because you thought you were something. Oh, by the way, we took you. And they're taunting Moab because, and guess what? We're coming to get you next. And Balak gets it. Because Balak says, okay, we got to figure something out. We got to stop this people. Maybe God will curse them. And so that's why he does the Balaam thing. Yeah, Larry? Yes.
Okay, so they beat them, and like you said, taunted them. I don't recall that it says in there anywhere where God stepped in and chased them with bees or
no.
Anything. So these guys are given a victory somehow, and then maybe they're getting the big head over it.
Very possible. Very possible. Yeah. Yeah, God really intervenes in Jericho. Exactly. Yeah, I think there's a growing confidence. I don't know if I'm going to say arrogance at this point, but there is a growing confidence in the nation now. And I think it's on purpose. I think there's a growing confidence because they got a big job ahead of them. Once they take this land, which we're going to, by the time they get to the end of Numbers, they're going to have all of this done. They're going to be ready to go into the land. They need confidence, not necessarily in themselves alone, but also in God, because they're getting ready to go into a land and unseat people and drive people out, supposedly. So I think there's a growing confidence that may be bordering on arrogance. It is interesting to me, like I said earlier, in this song, God's name isn't mentioned. No place in any of the songs, in any of those three songs that we sang in Numbers chapter 21, no place is God glorified or is God mentioned or is God honored or is God lifted up. There's joy, there's excitement, there's happiness, there's singing, but they're not terribly spiritual songs. That doesn't mean that they're spiritually, you know, bereft. I'm not saying that. It's interesting to me that when they came across, here's the difference for me. When they came across the Red Sea, I will sing unto the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and rider fell into the sea, right? Not the same case here. When they take Sihon, when they take the Amorite, when they take the land of the Amorites, they sing, ha ha, you're dead. That's my paraphrase. Ha ha, you're dead, and we're coming to get you next. That's kind of the song they sing, and so it feels a little different, but they're not done yet. They're going to get some more land. So look at verse 21. I'm trying to get through chapter 21 today. I got 1 minute to try to get there. Then Israel lived in the land of the Amorites. So they actually stayed there and lived there for a while. And Moses sent to spy out Jazer, and they captured its villages and dispossessed the Amorites who were there. So they take more in the land of Amorites. Then they turned up and went up the way of Bashan, and Og, the king of Bashan, came out against them, and he and all his people to battle at Edrei. But the Lord said to Moses, "Do not fear, for I've given into your hand and all his people and all his land, and you shall do to him as you did to King Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon." So they defeated him and his sons and all his people, and he had no survivor left, and they possessed his land. So now that they've defeated two kings, this king named Og comes out against them to fight against them, thinking, okay, I can do better than Sihon did. He comes out against them, and God says, nope, I'm going to give him to your hand as well. And so Moses, they fight against him, they beat him, they dispossess him, and they take his land as well. So now, think of where we are. We're now on the east side of the Jordan. They're actually not necessarily all traveling around all the time anymore. They're actually settling in and dwelling in and staying in those places. We know because of history tells us that they're still getting manna. That's still happening. Manna stops as they cross over the Jordan. That's when manna stops. But until they cross over the Jordan, they're still getting manna. But they're actually dwelling in and settling down in places. Some of them are now living in cities. Some of them are living in houses. They're actually settling this land. We'll know later on that Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh actually get allotted this section of land over here, and they're going to stay there. They're going to stay there for a while. I want to do this. Secular history actually has found a stone, a stela, if you will, that actually recounts some of this from the perspective of the Amorites, and walks back through how some of the Amorites took possession of land back from the Jews. It's an interesting read when you read from their perspective how they overthrew those war-making Jews. Now they took land back from them. So Israel didn't hold this land necessarily forever. In fact, they don't hold it today because it was taken back by some of the Amorites. So I'll get in maybe a little bit of that more next week as we approach Balak and Balaam. So anyhow, that was fun. I'll let you go. Enjoy the service. I think it's going to be, I'm really looking forward to the celebration of the Lord's Supper. I'm really looking forward to the celebration of baptism and just the focus this morning on the cross, on the work of Christ and salvation. I'm really excited about that. You're dismissed. We'll see you. Go get your kids out of the nursery if you got them.